All right, all right, all right. Nice to have you guys listening to the podcast. Appreciate you checking it out. Before we get to my guests, I want to thank everybody that's leaving comments on iTunes. And those of you who haven't, you're letting me down. So you can make up for it. Just go and say a nice little thing. Give us a nice rating. It helps on iTunes. It's great to have that out there. And that was Mother's Day. I hope you did something nice for your mom. I got my mother two gifts. My mother's 90 and still running her furniture store and won't buy anything. She grew up in the Depression. So she doesn't use filing cabinets. So I got her filing cabinets for her business because she puts all of her bills and files in styrofoam coolers because they're lightweight and they're easy to carry around. Yeah. Might seem funny to you, but when she gets audited by the IRS, looks like she's going on a picnic. And my mother's never been to a movie in a movie theater. I'm not kidding you. I don't know if there was some criminal activity and she's been banned, but I got her a really, really cool gift on deepdiscount.com. And don't turn away. My sponsor, I need you to support them because they support me and that gets you the podcast. Deepdiscount.com has this really cool Blu-ray DVD 70th anniversary remastered edition of Citizen Kane. Maybe the best movie ever. It looks unbelievable. And my mom really enjoys it, although she was freaking out the whole time that the DVD player was going to catch fire. That's a story for another day. So go to deepdiscount.com. If you're tired of renting or you know, you can't find what you're looking for on on-demand and you're searching and you're tired of it, go. It's a great website. You're going to find thousands of movies and TV shows at incredible prices. Click their logo on my homepage. You'll see what I mean. It's right there. And you baby boomers, and you know who you are, 1945 to 1964, if you were born in that time frame, you're going to find extra savings on thousands of your favorite titles from back in the day, like The Thomas Crown Affair. Great movie. They did a remake of it with Pierce Brosnan and Rene Russo, but the original, that's the one you want to get. That's with Steve McQueen. Doesn't get cooler than that. Great movie. I miss Rene Russo, though. She's a very lovely woman, and she and I have had a lot of involvement together in my head. I also got the whole series of Happy Days. And that show, I was never more shocked. Literally, I was like knocked out of commission for a week when I found out the Fonz was actually Jewish. Man, that guy can act. I got to tell you, because, woo, Henry Winkler. Who saw that coming? So there's all sorts of great stuff under the Baby Boomers category on sale right now. So go find your favorite. Stop wasting time searching with a remote, hoping to find something good to watch. Buy the shows you want to watch and own them forever. Come on. How many times do I have to tell you this? Out this week, Black Panther, the blockbuster hit from Marvel Studios, is one of the biggest movies of the year, and you can get your copy now on Blu-ray, DVD, and Ultra HD for a great price at deepdiscount.com. I saw this movie in the theater. It's phenomenal. The guy looks like a panther. I'm not going to lie to you. I think I gave the movie away, but there you go. And by the way, if you do the DVD, I'm pretty sure that your DVD player will not catch fire. So go get Black Panther. Check out some other great deals on deepdiscount.com. Be good to yourself. Treat yourself. It's worth it. My guest this week, John August, a great, great screenwriter and just a phenomenal author as well. Really cool conversation about working in Hollywood, being a screenwriter for some big films, working with the great director, Tim Burton. Enjoy, John. Go leave some comments and check out deepdiscount.com. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Before we get started, I want to thank everybody who's been leaving some nice comments on iTunes about the podcast. It really helps to get great reviews and kind words. So thank you. And if you haven't done it, shame on you. And swing by and say a little something. It's always great to have that. And my guest this week is screenwriter and novelist and podcast host. And I'm running out of things I can say about him, John August, who has written such amazing movies as Big Fish, Charlie's Angels, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Frankenweenie, and hosts a really great screenwriting podcast, Script Notes with Craig Mazin, and also has a relatively new podcast out called Launch, and it's produced by Wondery, and there's a terrific book, Arlo Finch in the Valley of Fire. John, welcome to the show. We ran out of time with all your credits. Thanks for being with us. No. All right.
It's nice to be here. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Yeah. There's so much
to talk to you about, in not just the amount of work you've done, but sort of how you approach it. But the screenwriting has been sort of the main thing, but this book is a really great book that you did. And there's an interesting quote that I saw you say, that most of the movies I've written are characters who are sort of caught between two worlds, which is something I relate to. And I realize my experiences of being 8, 10, and 12 was like being caught between two worlds. What was that like? I know you grew up in Colorado. So in what way were you, what were those worlds like? And was that a hard time as a kid, or was that a fun time?
Yeah, I had a great childhood. I grew up in Colorado in Boulder, right at the edge of the mountains, was acting in Scouts and doing all that. But I think like a lot of kids, and honestly, a lot of writers who I talk to as grownups, you spend a lot of your time with a sort of one foot in the real world and the other foot in sort of your imagination, and sort of this world you sort of imagine. Mm-hmm. You know, I was a kid who was just as active in Boy Scouts as playing D&D. Mm-hmm. And so Arlo Finch is sort of the character who is sort of both of those worlds. It's, you know, my experience in Scouts kind of pushed to the fantasy place. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, a lot of times the reason why, you know, people like you and me end up writing stuff is because we sort of imagine this different world and want to be able to take this world that's in our head and stick it out there for other people to see.
Well, it's funny because I just had Katie Couric on the show, and she has a 6-part docuseries on Nat Geo, which you, if you haven't seen, you should. And one is on technology and the effects on us as people. And she speaks to an expert who talks about the importance of turning off technology so that there's boredom, because boredom leads to creativity and imagination. And he said, we're getting less and less of that. And so this really struck a chord with me.
Absolutely. I think, you know, boredom was a crucial aspect of my childhood. I mean, we didn't have, you know, Twitter or anything else to distract us. So we could watch, you know, the reruns on TV, but a lot of times you were just sort of staring out the window. Mm. And that staring out the window time was really crucially foundational for sort of how I thought about how, you know, the universe worked, and how, what I wanted to do with my time. I mean, even in comedy, you know, so often, you know, you have to sort of rush to sort of make the first joke or figure out like, what is going to approach to this thing, and not actually think about the thing itself. You're always sort of reacting to rather than sort of acting. And boredom is a crucial way of planning how you're going to act.
Yeah. I mean, it's when I was writing on The Daily Show, it was like taking a final exam every morning, because we had 3 hours. We get our assignment, we get headlines, and you just start ripping through the research and trying to come up with as many good jokes as you can. And so there wasn't a lot of time for, it's a weird situation where you have to be creative with a gun to your head. And I think that's why, you know, you have more than one or two people on a staff, because on any given day, somebody's going to be on and somebody's going to be off, you know? And so, but I find often, like I also do stand up, like I'll be taking a nap, and in between just sort of dozing off, I'll get a thought, or just after waking up, I get a thought. And Tom Fontana writes every morning starting at sunup for about 3 hours, because he's still kind of in a dream state, he said, and that's one of his, that's the most productive period.
Yeah, I have other writer friends who basically no one's allowed to talk to them for like the first 2 hours. They just sort of go off and they just, you know, put stuff on the page, and then the rest of the day starts.
Yeah.
I've never been that kind of morning page person. Mm-hmm. And I think when I was younger, when I was in my 20s, like back when I was doing Go, that was a time where I really could stay up all night. I could like just get inspired, just like crank through all night and then sleep all day if I needed to. Mm. But then you get older, you have a family, like it becomes impossible to sort of like be a human being,
right,
and be a good parent and do that stuff. So I've had to be a little more regimented about like, this is the time I'm carving out to do this work. Mm. And I'll protect that time, but it's going to be at a time that I can also protect my family life and everything else.
Yeah. You seem to, in addition to bridging this gap, there's sort of this fantastical universe that you like to sort of live in with your work. And did that sort of start as a child, or what is it about that world that draws you to it or seems to bring you back to it?
I think I've always been obsessed with the notion that there's another world just beyond what I can see. Mm-hmm. Like this couldn't be it. And that there must be some way to get into that other world.
Even as a kid,
I always imagined that there was, it was sort of that Narnia kind of quality. Like, you know, I would always believe there has to be a secret door at the back of this bookcase that'll get me into that extra space. Mm-hmm. And most of the things I write are still some version of that. Even like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, you know, it starts in the real world and then goes into Wonka's factory, which is not possible. It's just like it's sort of magic inside there.
Right.
And I always have responded to those kinds of stories, you know, characters who leave the normal physical world and travel into some other place and are kind of changed by it and change it in the process.
Yeah, you said, I've always been that person who sees something that looks really interesting, whether it's a new genre, a new form of storytelling, or going off and doing a book. I always like, oh, that seems really interesting. Let me start wandering. And that really goes back to that particular person in the Katie Couric episode. And you also said that you kind of, you don't let yourself sort of, if it's not going where you think it should go or can go, you don't sort of walk away. You kind of have to stick to it. And I expand on that a little bit. I was really fascinated by that.
So often, like, I think people throw up these roadblocks in before they start doing their work because like, well, I don't know how to really do that. I don't know how to make it perfect. They get sort of obsessed with like the finished product before they start making the product. Mm-hmm. And I've always been the kind of person who's like, I don't really know how this works or what it is, but I'm just going to try it. And I will.
And you've always been like that.
I've always been like that. Yeah.
That's so amazing.
I remember even with screenwriting, I didn't even know there was such a thing as screenwriting until I saw the movie Sex, Lies, and Videotape. And then there was a book version of Sex, Lies, and Videotape that had the script and then his production diaries, Soderbergh's production diaries. Mm-hmm. And so then I bought the book and I watched the movie again and I flipped the pages and realized like, oh wow, everything they say is written down on this script. Which seems so obvious, but this is pre-internet. Like, I just didn't really understand how screenwriting worked.
And so, you didn't know there were scripts. You knew there were scripts for movies, obviously. But
this sounds so impossible, but I really did not know that there were scripts for movies. I did plays in high school,
yeah.
But I didn't understand that there was a similar kind of document that was the basis of a movie. Mm-hmm. You know, I think my first instinct that there was something there was I watched War of the Roses, which I just loved. And so we wound the tape and started again and like just wrote down everything they were saying.
I love that movie too. And I just saw Ben Mankiewicz interviewed Michael Douglas about it. And I just thought that was such a great movie on so many levels.
Yeah, you could make that movie again today and it would still be just as true. Like the sense that all relationships are both attraction and, you know, destruction.
Yeah. And it really goes there too. Like when they get down and dirty, man, it really goes there. I'm like, is this really going to end the way it seems like it's going to end? Like it's crazy. But anyway,
we've done versions of that story other times. I mean, Mr. and Mrs. Smith is kind of a variation on that.
Right.
Where like that kind of attraction leads to sort of, you know ruination. But
right.
I loved that movie and realized it was the first time it's like, oh, there really is a plan behind all this. And then I read Soderbergh's book. It's like, oh, okay, this is what the plan looks like. And it's like, I'm going to start just writing one of those, not really knowing how to do it, not knowing sort of what the official way to do it was. I was just like, well, I see there's int and ext, and so I'll start seeing.
Are
that
you
way.
Kidding me? Like you just literally like, because I would think it would seem so intimidating, like it's so complicated, and then it takes, one could look at it this way. Oh, there's all these rules and the thing, and it's so complicated. It's taking all the fun out of it. You seem to jump right into it. I guess that's just your nature, huh?
I think the thing you have to remember is you're always thinking about, well, what is the final product? It's like, ultimately, you're not writing a script. You're writing a movie. So I know what the movie is in my head. So let me try to sort of take this movie I have in my head and put it on paper, and I'll try to use the conventions that I see are here. Uh-huh. I mean, I didn't even have like that Sid Field book. It was before then even. So I was just trying to do it. And the process of trying to do it is where you learn, you know, how it kind of all works. It's like trying to teach somebody how to cook, but not actually letting them like, you know, touch the pans.
Yeah.
Got at some point, just like make some really crappy omelets. And eventually like, oh, this is how it all works. And so I get frustrated by sort of the rules of screenwriting and sort of the industry of like trying to profit off of the dream of screenwriting, because you know, it shouldn't be a profitable business to, you know, make people feel like they could be a screenwriter. Just like put that information out there. It should be free. So I started my website and started the podcast largely because I feel like I do kind of know how all this works. Mm-hmm. And if I were that kid back in Boulder who was, you know, had just watched War of the Roses and wanted to write a script, I'd Google it. And so if I could be the answer to that Google query, I'll put it out there.
And explain to people, I mean, I've heard it, but explain to people a little bit sort of how that particular podcast works in terms of, you know, sort of what you choose to talk about episode to episode and all of that.
Yeah, so we're on 350 episodes in. So every week we talk about screenwriting and things that are interesting to screenwriters. So Craig Mazin is super, super smart. He's mostly known as a comedy writer. He did the Hangover movies and other things, but he works a lot and is really smart about, you know, both the business and the craft. And we come at that from different perspectives. So we answer listeners' questions, but we'll also talk about stuff happening in the industry, certain writing challenges. We'll talk about, like, here are four stories in the news. If those got thrown our direction, how do you make movies out of those four stories? And mm-hmm. what are the characters? What are the challenges? So it's just a discussion about the craft and ends up being in some ways a weekly therapy session, because to know that I have this structured right. 1 hour each week and I'm going to be talking about this thing is really helpful. It's like the same way that people, you know, go to their trainer or go to yoga classes. It's just like provides a little time to think about what you're actually doing, because so often we're just doing it without any introspection.
Any reflection. Have you walked into an episode like sort of in a quandary over something regarding screenwriting and sort of the conversations that that episode or maybe a couple of episodes later helped you figure that problem out?
Absolutely. And a recent example is we had a great conversation with Christina Hodson, who's a screenwriter who's really fascinated with how do we improve inclusion and equity and representation in our movies, and how does that start at the writing process? And like, how do we take a look at scripts we're writing so that ultimately when we're making the movies, the world better reflects the real world that we live in? Mm-hmm. And so she and I had this great conversation, and through that conversation, you know, we ultimately sort of got to changes in this application that my company makes called Highland that lets you go through a script and basically, you know, show what the breakdown is of male and female characters speaking. So like, I can tell you that the women had 23% fewer lines in this script. And then it lets you sort of figure out like, okay, well, what do I change in order to make that balance a little bit more equal? Like, if this character were female, how would that affect the balance? But that was all just a conversation with her. Hmm. And so to have that sort of time set aside each week to really think about what you're doing
right. Is
crucial.
So in writing, in sort of delving into screenwriting, you mentioned the business of screenwriting and the business of that entertainment business. Sort of what hit you? What was the learning curve? What surprised you? What disappointed you and made you realize, well, I got to live with it because this is the business.
You know, I always assumed that screenwriting was just about the words on the page mm-hmm. and that it was about like, oh, if I write a really good script, then they'll make a really good movie mm-hmm. and people pay me to write other movies. And the words on the page matter a lot, but a good chunk of the real profession of screenwriting is the psychological aspect of being able to sit across from somebody, mm-hmm. describe this movie that you see, listen to what the movie is that they see, and try to come to a consensus. Because mm-hmm. unlike a novel, a screenplay is just a template, a blueprint for making this movie.
For the director.
Yeah, for the director, for the producers, for the studio. There's so many people involved in the decision of what kind of movie that's going to be. And so as the screenwriter, you're trying to use your words to describe that movie, but you're also using your, you know, skills in the room to get everyone to see the same movie.
And
a lot of times,
Oh no, go ahead. A lot of times.
So a lot of times when I'm brought in to work on a project, it's not because I'm a better writer than some other folks. It's just that I can actually be in the room with those folks and listen to them and have them listen to me, that I could sort of serve that function of calming everybody down a sec and getting us sort of to all think about the same way forward. So that psychological aspect I had never really considered until I was in the middle of it. And I was a pretty significant introvert when I started this. And it's like, well, 20 years in this business has made me sort of much more, you know, social, gregarious, able to sort of like roll with those situations.
So it sort of goes back to what you said about, you know, trying new things and not looking back. It's sort of here you are kind of forced to be an extrovert in a lot of ways and sort of, you know, play well with others in these meetings, which, as we probably both know, people, creatives, who just, you can't put them in a room with business people because they're intractable and they're not flexible. but you found you pretty quickly took to those waters of being, you know, able to sort of get everybody in the room to get on the same page and sort of really reach out to people.
Yeah. And so I recognized like, oh, this is a thing that I can do pretty well.
Right.
What that didn't translate into this not right away was I got right after my first movie Go, I got offered like, hey, you should do a TV show. So I set up a TV show at the WB and I was just way out of my depths. I had no idea how to run a TV show, how to run a writer's room, how to run a production that was taking place in two different cities across the country.
Yeah.
You know, I was overwhelmed. And it was also, you know, it was a good lesson in sort of the dangers of sort of just jumping in, not knowing anything. So I think I got much smarter at when I do jump in, I also look around for like, who are the folks who can help me out here? Like, how do I try not to do everything by myself because I can't.
Did you find it hard to, at some point you have to give up control of your baby, right? In the screenwriting process to the producer and the director, ultimately, how hard is that for you, and how involved have you been in generally in your movies in terms of rewrites as the movie's being shot?
It varies on every movie. So a film like Big Fish, you know, it's the movie I wrote and Tim Burton went off and shot that, but I was not really involved in the production. I was there for a pre-production. I saw them off and then I saw the first cut and sort of gave notes based on that. Go, my first movie that was produced, I was there every second, every frame shot. I directed second unit. I was in the editing room all the time on that because that's what that movie needed. And that's what that team would have me do. Mm. So it completely varies based on the project.
Is it hard? It's
hard to give it up. It just is. Because yeah. I've seen the movie in my head. My friend, Aline Brosh McKenna, reminds us that you as the writer, you're the only person who's seen the movie. And
that's interesting. Yeah.
Even the movies I've loved that turn out great, like it does look a little different in my head. And I always have to try to stop myself from trying to make a change just because it doesn't match what's in my head. Like it's different, but like, is it different and as good or better? Great. Let's let, you know, that vision that's on the screen stick around.
Well, I mean, you know, I know when we would write our jokes and give them to John Seward and then, you know, we go to rehearsal and then he'd do it, but then tweak it. And then he, you know, you get a little bit like, but it's the joke is perfect the way it is, you know? And, you know, most of the time what he did to it was great too, but there is that just incredible, intense feeling of ownership. And I was really fascinated by that experience as a screenwriter, because you really do at some point just kind of throw your baby out there and, you know, put your kid in somebody else's hands. And that's not an easy thing to do.
So part of the reason why I wanted to go off and do the Arlo Finch books is like, it was a chance to actually sort of not give up that control for a change, to actually have every word be the word I wanted it to be and matter. So it's been great. Books are really tough. I don't know if you've written a book, but it's just so many words.
Yeah. I mean, something to the effect that the amount of people involved in the production of a book surprised you. And explain that to people a little bit who, I think most listeners haven't written a book, what that was like and where the surprises came for you.
Yeah. I'm, as a screenwriter, I'm totally used to the fact like there's an entire crew making that movie. So there's 80 people, most of whom you're never going to meet. And then there's the marketing team and there's everybody else. It's, you know, going out to theaters and there's going to be the concession guy and the person tearing the tickets. There's obviously a huge industry that's supporting that movie that goes out there. But I kind of thought that books were like, well, there's the author, I guess there's an editor, and then the publisher puts it out there and you're done. As I started recording this podcast called Launch, which is just about the process of this book from idea to completion. And you realize like, man, there are a ton of people involved in the process of making a book, more than just the editor and, you know, the copy editor, but coming up with like the cover design and the audiobook and, you know, the designers picking like which typeface we're going to use. I went out and visited the printing plant in Harrisonburg, Virginia, where they actually printed the whole book. And so you see this massive factory that it's just there to produce books. And the attention to detail that like each of these people on the line are like, are you know, they're obsessed with making sure that the book works just the way it should. Right. And the glue is hot enough that everything sticks properly, but they're never going to read that book.
Right.
And there's a whole big bin of like slightly misprinted books that they're going to shred and put back away. It was just, It was so humbling to see that this thing I'd made, which I perceived to be my work, the physical thing is the product of, you know, really hundreds, maybe 1,000 people getting it out there in the world.
What I love about you is like the story of how you decided to write the book. You were on the phone with a friend and he was talking about writing a book and you hung up and thought, you know, maybe instead of adapting the book that you guys are talking about for screenplay, you decided, why don't I write a book? And then that night you wrote the first chapter of the book that exists in the book. Like, how does that just, your mind's able to work that fast, huh? And just jump right in.
You know, it was an idea that was floating around for a while, but I think the form of it was new that night. I could just like, okay, well, I should start this now. Rather than sort of putting off to someday, like, well, what is the harm in just starting this now? And so I just started writing and I wrote the whole first chapter and like, that's still the first chapter. It's very much like my first attempt at screenwriting back after reading Sounds Like a Videotape. It's like, well, it's going to be something like this. Mm-hmm. And let me just try to do the thing rather than research it to death.
And again, it wasn't like you went out and took a course on how to write books or started reading books on how to write books. You just kind of went with what you felt you wanted to say and your style. And did you just sort of develop a style over time, or how would you describe your style as a novelist?
No, it's very much my speaking voice. It's like a slightly different version of my speaking voice. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just as you described, like Jon Stewart would change the wording so it sort of fit his style.
Right.
You know, everything that's in Arlen Finch, I should be able to read aloud and have it sound like me. Mm-hmm. And so even as you get through copy edits, like there'd be times where they'd be changing my grammar a little bit and I'd have to tweak that again to make it sound like, okay, yes, that's grammatically correct, but it's not the way I would actually say it. Mm-hmm. So it's got to, you know, even though I'm not going to read the audiobook myself, I should be able to read the audiobook. So finding that voice was pretty natural.
And it seemed like it was a freeing experience for you, because I know you said that, this is your quote, screenplays are just ruthlessly efficient. And I think I know what you mean by that, but explain to folks who may not be familiar with writing, like what does that mean?
Well, if you think about a movie and imagine the document behind that movie, it's always going to have all the dialogue. So it's everything that people are saying to each other. And it's going to have enough action and scene description to let you know the broad strokes of what's happening in that scene, sort of the crucial actions that characters are taking, description of the world enough that we can get a sense of it. But it has to be really, really thin. It has to be really efficient, because you know you're trying to convey the experience of this visual medium on the page. So you're really looking for like, how can I say this in one sentence rather than four?
And sometimes you don't need to say anything because it's a visual medium and you're telling story in pictures. Yep. So that the actor's face will tell that, make that, write that line for you.
Yes. And so you have to decide at what points do I need to like actually say in the script, like he gives a look that indicates something, rather than whole process of trying to distill it down to its barest form. Mm-hmm. And the dialogue in movies tends to be incredibly efficient in a way that, like, you know, it's getting to its point much more quickly than we would in the real world. And so as I was going back to write the book of Arlen Finch, I actually suddenly had a little more time, a little more space. And if you were trying to do the dialogue, the book, the same way you did it for the movie, it wouldn't work. There's a different expectation we have on how characters talk to each other in books than they do in movies. So it was that process was just a huge adjustment.
Yeah. We're going to jump in a second here, and there's a lot more I'd love to talk to you about. So I think I want to get you back on. But the book itself was sort of almost somewhat autobiographical in a way, right? Like, what were you trying to, what the story there for you was important for what reason?
Well, you know, I was that, you know, kid stomping around the mountains of Colorado and sort of, you know, having a lot of the adventures that Arlen Finch does.
Right.
This is just pushed into sort of the fantasy world. So just the same way that, you know, British kids go to boarding schools, but they don't have magic. I had scouts. So I can imagine, like, well, scouts plus magic would be a kind of a cool combination.
Right.
It was also a really, you know, I mean, well, it was obviously a foundational time of my life, but also I think one of the things I really took from scouts was that sense of principles. You know, scouts have the scout oath, the scout law, and it's a set of like, sort of like, these are your best practices. These are the things I'm going to aim for. I'm going to try to be this kind of person. Mm-hmm. And Arlo Finch has an equivalent set of principles he's taught and has to sort of figure out what they actually mean. So often we're told to memorize something, but not really understand it. And so the books are a chance to sort of try to figure out what do these principles mean in actual life and how do you sort of struggle to enact them in your daily work.
Yeah, and that trait, that aspect of it makes it feel almost like a sort of a tip of the hat to, I don't want to say a bygone era, but it definitely had a sense of that sort of lost purity, if you will, you know, sort of that you were able to capture in the book from that time as your child in your childhood.
Yeah.
Well, listen, thanks for, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. But thanks.
Yeah. It's really great to have you on and, let folks, let's run through where they can hear you and see you and all that good stuff. You have Script Notes with Craig Mazin and where can folks get that podcast?
That's everywhere you get your podcast. Right. So both Script Notes and Launch are available kind of everywhere, that people, wherever you're listening to this show right now, it's probably where you can listen to.
Sounds good.
Script Notes
and the book is, the novel's really, really great. I recommend it. Arlo Finch in the Valley of Fire. You also have a new app out, you mentioned.
So Highland 2, what I was talking about with the gender analysis stuff, Highland 2 to ship today. So that's an app. It's a free download on the Mac App Store if you want to check that out.
All right. And of course, go check out his movies too. They're going to be out there forever. They're just terrific. Thanks for being on, man. Appreciate it. And
appreciate it.
Yeah, this is a lot of fun.
All right. There you go. John August, great guy. Please leave some comments on iTunes. And we really appreciate that. Appreciate you guys tuning in every week. You guys are great. And we'll see you next week.